I'm going to give a quick motivation for these two lectures on poems I like and why. I assume you all know why art in general is a need of human life, namely to concretize your view of life, to take something that you hold in very abstract terms and translate it into the vivid reality of a percept. Now, in regard to art, literature is one of the most crucial, most accessible. Unfortunately, most objectivists confine themselves to a small sample of available world literature. And I'm talking about good, enjoyable, eloquent literature. The objectivists I know generally know Ayn Rand's novels, maybe some of the more famous romantic novels, a lot of mystery and adventure and movies and TV. And I think it's a shame. That's it. I think it's a shame. I think you are, those of you, I'll accept those of you to whom that doesn't apply. But the rest of you, that's an impoverishment of what art can bring you in your life. It has to lead to boredom and an atrophy of interest. And if art is, as Ayn Rand said, a crucial nourishment of life, then you are engaged in self-imposed malnutrition. If it's a banquet, you are starving when there are countless courses on the table to sample, savor, and delight in. Now, I've been pursuing this theme for several years now. I gave a course on great dramas to try to introduce objectivists to dramas. I gave a course on non-objectivist novels. I actually had the brass to try to sell Dostoevsky and Tolstoy. And they had some success. There are groups around the country reading plays right now and talking about them and who get pleasure and a certain spiritual fulfillment even if they're non-objectivist in content, within limits, obviously. Now, these two lectures are my final effort in this series on literature for objectivists. And, of course, it is poetry. There is a mass of wonderful poetry written through the past centuries, unknown and inaccessible to most objectivists. As soon as they hear poetry, they think it's something esoteric, arty, pretentious, unreal, you know, archaic, not for me. And the reason people think that is primarily because of what you get in school or if you read art criticism. Now here, just as a quick sample from last Sunday's New York Times, a book called How to Read a Poem by Edward Hirsch. I haven't seen it, just the review. But it gives you an idea what the schools offer as poetic criticism, which would make anybody throw up and run for their lives. He's analyzing the final stanza of a poem by James Wright, of whom I never heard. The poem is called Hook, and here's the whole final stanza. I took it. It wasn't the money I needed, but I took it. Hirsch Wright. Here's his comment. There is an emphatic tautness in the twice repeated one-syllable word took. Pause for a moment over the masterful use of sound in the phrase took it, probably the harshest trochee in American poetry. What about axe it or whack her? But no, it has to be took it. Then he gives a description of what the tongue does when the reader says, I took it aloud. Quote, it moves behind the teeth, shoots back against the soft palate, then back to the teeth again. The sound all this makes, the feeling inside the mouth is intense. For an instant, it reduces the speaker to one who makes animal sounds. Repeat the phrase, I took it aloud twice, put in a disavowal about money, and it starts to have harsh sexual overtones. Now, you see, anybody would just say, if that's poetic analysis, to hell with it. It's absurd. But that's not the proper way. I want to introduce you to some poetry that you may not know, simply via some poems that are my favorites, and my only goal is to show you that poetry as such can be interesting, enjoyable, and you shouldn't write it off. And then you can go and browse as you wish. Now, since poetry virtually can't survive translation, all of the poems that I'm going to quote are written in English originally. Now, I don't like all the ones that I'm going to read in the sense of I don't agree with them. But sometimes an eloquent statement capturing an opposite view of life enables you to appreciate and enjoy the purposefulness and mastery of the artist despite his views, and at the same time makes you more conscious by contrast of your own views and values. So I can, I admit it right here, enjoy a great malevolent universe poem, although that's not my dominant taste, and it's not going to be dominant today. But every once in a while I'm going to zing one in just to show you that it's possible. Now, the first class is going to be more didactic. I'm going to try to have room for some questions, including more general questions about the universe at large at the end. And the second class, there are some love poems and some great humorous poems I want to cover. But I know that this was announced as a three-hour radio show. So I'm going to be guided to some extent by you in the second one. If you have a lot of stuff about what's going on in the world and you want to ask, and I have answers, if you ask stuff of general interest, I won't force poetry on you for the whole second session. You can convert it to, you know, general discussion of the world. But I have plenty of poems here, at least enough for three or four lectures, so I'm not going to run out. Now, the first thing before I even define poetry is you must renounce your fear of it. You have to abandon the idea that poetry and pleasure are opposites. And to do that, I'm going to read you two really short poems by a really great American poet, Ogden Nash. All I know is he died in 1971. One is called The Pizza, and it's just six lines. Look at Itsy Bitsy Mitzy. See her figure slim and ritzy. She eats a pizza. Greedy Mitzy. She no longer Itsy Bitsy. Now, I'll just leave that for a minute and one more, and then I'll use them as some examples. This is a poem that takes a serious subject. You know, people who claim that they're victims and put the responsibility for their problems on others, and he treats it in four lines. And it's called Which the Chicken, Which the Egg. He drinks because she scolds, he thinks. She thinks she scolds because he drinks. And neither will admit what's true, that he's a sot and she's a shrew. Now, these two little funny poems contain, in essence, all the elements of all poetry, including great poetry. And I'll come back to them in a minute. Let's start with my definition of poetry. I didn't even look in the dictionary because I'm 100% sure of this. The form of literature whose medium is the sound of concepts. The form of literature, that's the genus, whose medium is the sound of concepts. Now, I use concept because obviously we're not talking about word salads or nonsense syllables. I didn't want to say word. I want to say concept to stress the meaning in poetry. But we're talking about the sound of concepts when we symbolize it and give a word to it and then say it aloud and vibrations come and strike the ear. The sound of concepts is the medium. Now, you can contrast this to a novel. A novel is also a conceptual medium. In that sense, it's essentially akin to poetry and plays. But a novel, even if it has emotively slanted words and has some poetic elements, that is merely stylistic elements within the essential form. The novel as such counts only on the meaning of concepts, not on their sound. Poetry, by contrast, is an auditory art, an auditory form of literature. Now, we know that all art reduces philosophy to the perceptual level. Now, the perceptual level in a novel is the concrete events and characters which the novelist has to make into unique concretes. Poetry may, but need not, have events and characters. Its indispensable perceptual element is sound. And thus, it's equivalent to music. I would say, actually, it's a cross between literature and music is the best classification. And just as it's possible to read sheet music, you know, just sit there and read it if you're an accomplished musician, but that is not how music is intended to be consumed. It's not yet music, it's just the notation for music. The same is true for poetry. You must always read it aloud, otherwise you don't get the sound. Even if you are by yourself, you cannot judge or even grasp or consume a poem by reading. You must hear the sounds fully or you miss the poetry. I stress that, and if you feel self-conscious, go into a soundproof room because you have to declaim it. It's not even good whispering it. Now, what do you listen for in a poem? What do you hear? What are the crucial elements of the sound? Two essential elements only, and then a lot of variations and so on, which we won't even look at. One is rhythm. Rhythm is the meter, the beat, the equivalent of the time signature in music. The regular pace or flow. If you play the piano, it's like the left hand. Da, 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 da. And there's a lot of different types of rhythms, depending upon how many da, da, da's are in a line, and how many little beats and big beats. That's all technical. But for instance, take this one, the chicken and the egg. He drinks because she scolds, he thinks. How many? Four, right? So they give that the tetrameter. You don't have to know that, but it has four beats. She thinks she scolds because he drinks. And neither will admit what's true, that he's a sot and she's a shrew. So that has a perfect meter. Every line has four beats. That's not necessary. You can, for emphasis, have different beats, like four and then three, four and then three, all kinds of different mixtures for emphasis. But you have to have a rhythmic pattern that keeps going, keeps the pace going, or it is not poetry. And then, the second, in my opinion, absolutely indispensable element is rhyme. Unfortunately, those two words in English, although they mean completely different things, have the same root, rhyme and rhythm, but don't mix them up because they're completely different things. Rhyme, in my definition, is a repeated pattern of recognizable sounds at the end of the lines. A repeated pattern of recognizable sounds at the ends of the lines. And this corresponds to the melody in music, or the right hand. And all poems have a rhyme scheme. That is, you use A for the first sound. And then every time that sound comes up again, you call it A, and B for the next. So for instance, the pizza. I'll just read the rhymes now. Mitzi, Ritzi, Itza, Pizza, Mitzi, Bitsy. So that's really simple. A-A, B-B, A-A. And there's all kinds of incredible combinations, but it's a repeated pattern, you see. So if you had a different ending for each one, there'd be no rhyme. It has to be the same sound coming at recognizable or graspable intervals. That's it. Those are the two essential elements of poetry. And the skillful combination of these two elements creates in you auditory expectations. Just as in music, certain phrases build up in your mind and you come to expect a climax and resolution. The moment the rhythm and the rhyme scheme is laid down in your ear, you are waiting for and expecting its continuation and then its fulfillment. You expect and need a resolution. Think, drink, true. It's got to be an ooh of some kind. The rhythm demands one more and the rhyme demands one more. So, if I said think, drink, true, anti-disestablishmentarianism, it would be death. It has to come as and when you expect it. And in some of the greater poems, though, the meaning is a total twist. As in here, they're ordinary and suddenly you hit, you're expecting that sound, but it has a completely different meaning that you're anticipating. So you get a great combination. The essence of rhyme and rhythm put together properly gives an emphasis and urgency to the sounds and thereby makes possible a sensory integration by the brain to accompany the intellectual integration of the meaning by your mind. When they're rhymed and rhythmed as you expect, then the reality you need intellectually and auditorily is fulfilled, and that has a power, a kind of power, that ordinary prose doesn't and can't. And now, of course, prose has its own kind of power that poetry can't. But it has a power and emotional impact because it's like the full union of brain and ears, or if you want it more philosophically, of mind and body. Both together are taking in the poem. Now, like all art forms, of course, its very attributes delimited. Poetry, by its nature, is suited to shorter works, because lengthy works in rhyme generally become artificial. To carry out 30, 50, 100, 200 pages, they end up having to use weird words to get it to rhyme. And the worst thing that they do is use lame rhymes out of desperation. Rhymes, words that are spelled the same but do not rhyme. And that is an abomination. It's a plague, like love and move, or mind and wind. Now, that's just, I'll stomach one or two of those, but that's unacceptable, unacceptable. So if you don't allow yourself, you have to sound natural. You just can't suddenly reach into an ancient English word because it rhymes with something. The trick of a poet is not to sound like a poet, and yet it rhymes. So it's most suited to the eloquent, powerful statement of a relatively simple thought, sentiment, inspirational idea, expression of love. You can tell a story, in effect the equivalent of a short story. You can tell a joke in poetry, but it does not have anything like the scope of a novel. And I have to say that by my definition, much of what is called poetry merely has what I would call an element of poetry. There's a vast literature that has rhythm without rhyme, like the long epic poems, like Shakespearean plays. Those are written usually in a very definite rhythm, but which contributes heavily to their effect, but those are not true poems in my opinion. They have an element of poetry, that's all. They're a cross between novels and poetry, or plays and poetry. If we get a chance, I'll read you an example later, but I am talking here about what I call real primary poetry. In case you wonder about free verse, that has neither rhyme nor rhythm. It's simply a typographical aberration. The words are put on the page arbitrarily in different lengths. That is free verse, is free of standards, value, reality. I mean, it's a typical modern nihilism. And It's not proper to talk about it in public because of what you would have to say to give the most modest comment. And that's for people who write me that they adore E.E. Cummings. Now, I want to start with some philosophical poetry, you know, that has an avowed philosophic theme. There's many other types, as we'll see. And to suck you into poetry, well, that's maybe not the right word, to introduce you in a positive way, I'm going to read you some excerpts from a poem that was a favorite of Ayn Rand, so that should intimidate you. I don't have time in these lectures to read the whole poems when they're long, and this one is like five long stanzas. So I'm excerpting, I'm cutting out sections, but you can always look it up and read the whole thing. The theme of this is obviously egoism and individualism. I'm not spoiling it by telling you that. It's called The Westerner by Charles Badger Clark. He was 1883 to 1957, and this poem was written in 1947 and first appeared in a magazine called The Rotarian. And I'm first going to read it for you, and then we'll do a tiny rhythmic and rhyme analysis and see what he accomplishes. And as I say, I'll tell you when I'm jumping. My fathers sleep on the sunrise plains, and each one sleeps alone. Their trails may dim to the grass and rains, for I choose to make my own. I lay proud claim to their blood and name, but I lean on no dead kin. My name is mine for the praise or scorn, and the world began when I was born, and the world is mine to win. They built high towns on their old log sills where the great slow rivers gleamed, but with new live rock from the savage hills, I'll build as they only dreamed. Jump. I waste no thought on my neighbor's birth or the way he makes his prayer. I grant him a white man's room on earth if his game is only square. While he plays it straight, I'll call him mate. If he cheats, I drop him flat. Old class and rank are a worn-out lie, for all clean men are as good as I, and a king is only that. I dream no dreams of a nursemaid state that will spoon me out my food. A stout heart sings in the fray with fate, and the shock and sweat are good. Food good. Jump. The sunrise plains are a tender haze, and the sunset seas are gray. But I stand here where the bright skies blaze over me and the big today. What good to me is a vague maybe, or a mournful might have been, for the sun wheels swift from morn to morn, and the world began when I was born, and the world is mine to win. That's good, don't you think? Ayn Rand had those last two lines, and the world began when I was born, and the world is mine to win, in a placard framed. Now, if you take a quick look at how he achieves the power of this poem, look first at the meter. It's because it's my fathers sleep on the sunrise plains, 4. And each one sleeps alone, 3. It's 4-3-4-3 all the way through, which means that the 3 gets more emphasis because da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And you stop. And you're caught up. And you get used to the pattern quickly enough. So, but when he gets to, and the world is mine to win, the 3 after the 4, it's punched. Also, if you notice his rhyme scheme. Plains, alone. Rains, own. Name, kin. Scorn, born, win. So, it's A, B, A, B, C, just to separate the two. And then D-E-E-D. So you, once you hear, but I lean on no dead kin, you know an in is coming. And then you hear, my name is mine for the praise or scorn. And the world began when I was born. And where is the in that your mind is waiting for? And here in a short three-beat line, suddenly, and the world is mine to win. And when that hits you with that combination of the three beats and a delayed rhyme, he switched the rhyme pattern on you, it hits with a real punch. And to make sure that you don't miss it, he repeats the last two lines again at the end of the stanza. Now that gives you a small example of what you could do with rhyme and rhythm, what really brilliant poets can do. The eloquence and the punch that is made possible by rhyme and meter. Now, to illustrate that, just I'm not going to most poems, I'm just going to zip through. But to give you an idea, I took five lines at random from the third stanza, and I wrote them in reputable prose, the same content. So I'm going to read you my prose, which is the same meaning, and then read you those five lines from the end of the third stanza. This is the content. So long as a man lives by the rules of morality, including being honest and not cheating, I regard him as a friend, at least potentially. If he is immoral in some essential, then he's no more a friend and I'll have nothing to do with him. I do not regard his socioeconomic status as relevant, nor his possession or lack thereof of a title of nobility. Such ideas belong to a primitive mentality and have no basis in reality. In my judgment, any moral man, no matter what his income or title, has the same virtue and moral standing as I do. In this sense, all men are equal, and that goes for kings as well. They are not superior to the rest of us merely by virtue of the of some aristocratic title having been bestowed on. Now, that is a real mouthful. You could take it in. Now, here, the exact same meaning in poetry. He's talking about a man playing a game. While he plays it straight, I'll call him mate. If he cheats, I drop him flat. Old class and rank are a worn-out lie. For all clean men are as good as I, and a king is only that. Now that is the best I can do to demonstrate to you the difference between counting only on concepts and using rhythm and rhyme. And you see that in this particular instance, it's infinitely superior, the poetry. It conveys the meaning with a power that prose simply can't do. It can't do it. All right, now without nearly as lengthy an analysis, I want to read you all kinds of different poems with some passing comments so you get an idea of the range. Now let's start, believe it or not, with some metaphysical poems. They directly give you a whole view of life in the universe. And I've picked three radically different views of life, all extremely eloquent and answering, in essence, the question, is life, you know, benevolent or malevolent, good or bad? I'm going to start with a fabulous poem by Richard Corey, C-O-R-Y. No, excuse me, that's the title, Richard Corey. And the author is Edwin Arlington Robinson. And all I know is 20th century. This is a fabulous poem, but listen. Whenever Richard Corey went downtown, we people on the pavement looked at him. He was a gentleman from sole to crown, clean favored and imperially slim. And he was always quietly arrayed, and he was always human when he talked. But still he fluttered pulses when he said good morning, and he glittered when he walked. And he was rich, yes, richer than a king, and admirably schooled in every grace. In fine, we thought that he was everything to make us wish that we were in his place. So on we worked and waited for the light and went without the meat and cursed the bread. And Richard Corey, one calm summer night, went home and put a bullet through his head. Now see, the whole thing is, life is wonderful. He's got everything. We admire him. He's handsome. He's rich. He's accomplished. And what does it all mean? Nothing. He's in total misery. Now, what philosopher is that a perfect expression of? Only one that would be that perfect. Even better than Schopenhauer. Because Schopenhauer wouldn't even allow a superficial happiness. Who says you can be happy on the surface, but in essence you are miserable. Wretched and crooked, ulcerous and bespotted. St. Augustine. This is a perfect Augustinian poem. And you see the power of that last line, because the rhythm and the rhyme are making you expect it has to end in ed, but and it has to be it has to be five. So you go there, and suddenly the ending that completely satisfies your ear after all this glowing description is a bullet in his head. And it comes with a shock. Now this is the perfect malevolent universe poem. I never found one to equal that. You see why I like it? Because it's so eloquent, so beautifully done, and it's like a punch in the face at the very end. I don't think you'd like the author. Now, here's a second view of life. This one is called Invictus, which is Latin for unconquered, by William Ernest Henley, who is 1849 to 1903. Now I'm going to read this first. Out of the night that covers me, black as the pit from pole to pole, I thank whatever gods may be for my unconquerable soul. In the fell clutch of circumstance, I have not winced nor cried aloud. Under the bludgeonings of chance, my head is bloody but unbowed. Beyond this place of wrath and tears looms but the horror of the shade. And yet the menace of the years finds and shall find me unafraid. It matters not how straight, narrow, the gate, how charged with punishments the scroll. I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. Now that is a perfect, perfect mixed poem, because it has a good and a bad element. Believes in free will. You are the master of your destiny. You have to fight to the bitter end, but it's a bitter fight all the way through against a hostile world. It's filled with bludgeonings, bloody heads, wrath, tears, menace, horror, punishment. But you're going to slog on and keep going no matter what. Now, who is that associated with, a famous poet? Lord Byron. This is the perfect expression of the Byronic view. And it's usually what happens when a malevolent universer becomes an objectivist. Without dropping the malevolent universe, they become Byronic. Now, this is the tragic fighter philosophy, which is, of course, a contradiction, because if it's doomed to fail, why fight? Now, let's look, just to complete it, at, take a guess, something positive. Now, unfortunately, I never found a great, eloquent, benevolent universe poem. I'm sure they must exist. It's like literature. It's very hard, or novels, it's very hard to find. But this is about the closest. And this man is Arthur Hugh C-L-O-U-G-H. What's that? Clough? 1819 to 1861. It's called Say Not the Struggle. And he's fed up, and this is the context, of people who say, oh, it's hopeless, it's useless, all is lost, we'll never achieve anything. His first stanza denounces and says all that's wrong. And then there's three stanzas following, which use three metaphors, which you'll be able to pick out. One, a battle. One, an ocean. And one, the sun or sunshine. So you can visualize his point through these three metaphors while also getting the auditory input, which makes it even more perceptual, his answer. Now, you might find it slightly obscure, but I hope not. I don't want to interpose too many clarifications because you lose the rhythm and the rhyme. Say not the struggle not availeth. The labor and the wounds are vain. The enemy faints not nor faileth. And as things have been, things remain. He says, don't say any of that. If hopes were dupes, fears may be liars. It may be in yon smoke concealed. Your comrades chase e'en now the flyers, and but for you possess the field. For while the tired waves, vainly breaking, seem here no painful inch to gain, far back through creeks and inlets making comes silent, flooding in the main, the ocean, you see. And not by eastern windows only, when daylight comes in the light. In front, the sun climbs slow, how slowly, but westward look, the land is bright. So I think that's a very eloquent to say, it looks bad where you are, but stand back. We're winning the battle. It looks like the water is beating forever against the unyielding rock, but look over there. The ocean is about to flood in. It looks like the sun is confined to one little patch, but look over there. The light, you see, and you have too narrow a vision, and that's why you say, the struggle not availeth. In other words, it's useless, and it accomplishes nothing. I think that is an excellent poem, not only in sentiment, but in the use of these three metaphors to make it visual, and it's the closest I've found to a benevolent universe poem. Now let's continue on one more metaphysical poem. This happens to be my top favorite of all poems. And it's by Rudyard Kipling. And it's the issue underneath benevolent versus malevolent universe. It discusses the question, do you accept reality or not? The I wish versus the it is. And if you read Opar, you know that if you go by I wish, you conclude it's a malevolent universe. And if you go by it is, the opposite. So this is really the deeper one. Did I give you Kipling's dates? 1865 to 1936. He was an enormously popular and beloved poet and went into total eclipse after, I think, World War I. They wouldn't touch him. He was old-fashioned. These sentiments are corrupt. But he was beloved in his time. This poem is called The Gods of the Copybook Headings. And you have to understand his symbolism here. He contrasts two types of gods. The gods of the market, that is not capitalism, they're supply and demand. By the market or the marketplace, he means where ignorant mobs follow the leader. You know, like they gather in the square and their emotions are stirred up and they'll do any irrational thing. It means really following emotion. And a copybook in the old days, you know, the kids did their homework in, and they used to have headings on each page. You know, essential wisdom, elements of wise sayings that they would din into the kids. You know, a stitch in time saves nine. Elementary truths. So they represent, in effect, the voice of reality. So it's a war between the gods of the marketplace, the ignorant emotionalist masses, and the facts of reality. Now, again, I have to omit some passages because of length, and also a few of them are obscure. But Monroe Trout told me, one of the people here, that he also loved this poem, and he got someone to contact. There is apparently a Kipling London office. If you phone it and say what words or phrases you don't get, they will tell you over the phone what it means. Or you can find Monroe and ask him, because he knows this poem better than I do. Now see, that's, I kind of enjoy poetry by sometimes not looking it all up and saying, well, I don't quite get that stanza, but I love the rest, and someday I'll look it up, but, you know, it's not a compulsive duty. It's not as though I'm lecturing on it, you know. All right. I have to say this is a bitter poem, but nevertheless very true. As I pass through my incarnations in every age and race, I make my proper prostrations to the gods of the marketplace. Peering through reverent fingers, I watch them flourish and fall. And the gods of the copybook headings, I notice, outlast them all. We were living in trees when they met us. That's the copybook. We were living in trees when they met us. They showed us each in turn that water would certainly wet us as fire would certainly burn. But we found them lacking in uplift, vision, and breadth of mind. So we left them to teach the gorillas while we followed the march of mankind. He's being sarcastic. We moved as the spirit listed. They never altered their pace, being neither cloud nor wind-borne like the gods of the marketplace. But they always caught up with our progress, and presently word would come that a tribe had been wiped off its ice field or the lights had gone out in Rome. That's common Rome. With the hopes that our world is built on, they were utterly out of touch. They denied that the moon was Stilton. They denied she was even Dutch. They denied that wishes were horses. They denied that a pig had wings. So we worshiped the gods of the market who promised these beautiful things. Now, a big jump. This is him on socialism. In the Carboniferous epoch, we were promised abundance for all by robbing selected Peter to pay for collective Paul. But though we had plenty of money, there was nothing our money could buy. And the gods of the copybook headings said, if you don't work, you die. And here comes my favorite stanza. I have it in a plaque. And I looked at that all the time I was writing Oprah. Then the gods of the market tumbled, and their smooth-tongued wizards withdrew. And the hearts of the meanest were humbled and began to believe it was true that all is not gold that glitters, and two make four. And the gods of the copybook headings limped up to explain it once more. That's the idea. I'm struggling through this book, and I had the effrontery to say I'm the copybook headings, and I'm limping up once more. And that I took the gods of the market as being the analyst. And here's the biting, bitter moral that he draws at the end. As it will be in the future, it was at the birth of man. There are only four things certain since social progress began. That the dog returns to his vomit, and the sow returns to her mire. and the burnt fool's bandaged finger goes wabbling back to the fire. That after this is accomplished and the brave new world begins, that's socialism, when all men are paid for existing and no man must pay for his sins, as surely as water will wet us, as surely as fire will burn, the gods of the copybook headings with terror and slaughter return. Isn't that a terrific? You have to applaud that, I think. It says so many terrific ideas, so beautifully expressed. So I definitely recommend Kipling to you. I'm going to read one more Kipling if we have time, which was Ayn Rand's favorite Kipling, which at her request was read at her funeral. You must know that poem. If he has a lot of great stuff. But I want to switch now to epistemology. Yes, there is poetry about epistemology. Here I'm going to start with a gem from Tennyson, Alfred Lord Tennyson, born 1809, died 1892. He's actually my top favorite poet. Okay, he has the most good stuff. And he's a very high-level poet. And this is a poem about integration. Very complex idea in philosophy, done as only can be done in poetry, in six lines through an image. A complex meter and rhyme poem, rhyme pattern, which you can analyze on your own. You just have to know the word cranny. You know, every nook and cranny, it's like an opening, a little crack. So a wall with crannies has little cracks. Called Flower in the Crannied Wall. Six lines. Flower in the crannied wall, I pluck you out of the crannies. I hold you here, root and all, in my hand. Little flower, but if I could understand what you are, root and all in all, I should know what God and man is. You get that idea? It's the idea that everything in the universe is interconnected. If you knew everything about any one part, all of its elements and constituents and interrelations and causal interactions, you would have to know the sum of omniscience. And that's the idea that I always quote, you know, the true is the whole. And this is captured in this beautiful little complex poem as an image. It always astounds me. I couldn't begin to explain that as briefly and beautifully as he does. Now let's go to the enemy on the same theme, an opponent of integration. In fact, an opponent of reason. This is William Wordsworth. He was a romanticist in the traditional 19th century sense, which meant a lot of good. He's held strong values. He really cared about beauty. You know his famous poem, The Daffodils, I wandered lonely as a cloud, and he sees the host of golden daffodils. But the romanticists of the 19th century, of course, were anti-reason. They thought it was a dichotomy. So he has some very anti-reason poems, and he's beloved today precisely because of that. And his way of making the contrast is between books and nature. Nature, you know, the natural, the untutored, the unread, is your innate intuition, your instincts. And books is words and learning and reason, you know, all that artificial stuff. And it's excellently perfect expression of how to be a passive mystic. It's like Tolstoy's view in poetry, utterly false and beautifully done, and that's why it's one of my favorites. Now, to get just the full meaning of one of his poems, To become double is to get really twice as fat, okay? The tables turned. Did I give you his dates? He's 19th century. This was written in 1888. That's all I know. The tables turned. And I'm going to omit several stanzas. Up, up, my friend, and quit your books, or surely you'll grow double. Up, up, my friend, and clear your looks. Why all this toil and trouble? Books, 'tis a dull and endless strife. Come, hear the woodland linnet. How sweet is music on my life. There's more of wisdom in it. Big skip. One impulse from a vernal wood may teach you more of man, of moral evil and of good than all the sages can. And this is the one that's always quoted. Sweet is the lore with the learning. Sweet is the lore which nature brings. Our meddling intellect misshapes the beauteous forms of things. We murder to dissect. Enough of science and of art. Close up those barren leaves. Come forth and bring with you a heart that watches and receives. Isn't that a fabulous statement of total mysticism? Clear, eloquent. I get a charge out of reading that because it really says perfectly a certain view with all the power of poetry. And now something as an antidote to this of Wordsworth. This is by Burton Braley, B-R-A-L-E-Y, a 20th century poet whom I really don't know at all, but this poem somebody gave me, and you'll get its message without me. It's essentially the theme of Atlas Shrugged. So I don't think you need me to explain it. It's called, and I'll read it all, The Thinker. Back of the beating hammer by which the steel is wrought, back of the workshop's clamor, the seeker may find the thought that is ever master of iron and steam and steel, that rises above disaster and tramples it under heel. The drudge may fret and tinker or labor with lusty blows, but back of him stands the thinker, the clear-eyed man who knows. For into each plow or saber, each piece and part and whole must go the brains of labor, which gives the work a soul. Back of the motors humming, back of the belts that sing, back of the hammers drumming, back of the cranes that swing, there is the eye which scans them, watching through stress and strain. There is the mind which plans them. Back of the brawn, the brain. Might of the roaring boiler, force of the engine's thrust, strength of the sweating toiler, greatly in these we trust. But back of them stands the schemer, the thinker who drives things through. Back of the job, the dreamer, who's making the dream come true. Isn't that a good one? Now, I grant you, you're going to like that more than Wordsworth. But partly, you get to appreciate poetry, and you can experience the power of it more than just, oh, he's for thought, you know, as the cause of everything. Now, because Tennyson is such a genius, I want to read a little bit from one of his famous poems, The Lotus Eaters. The idea is taken, this is not a philosophical poem, it's taken from the Odyssey, you know, the Homeric epic, the old Greek legend that Ulysses travels on all meets has all these the fantastic places that he comes to and so on. And in this particular passage, we're looking at it just as what a truly great poet can do with rhyme and meter. And this is just the choric song from the Lotus Eaters. In fact, just a part of it, a few excerpts. His desire, the Lotus Eaters in that island that they're coming to, they eat this stuff and they can't stay awake. It puts them to sleep. So he's got to give you poetry through sound that induces that heaviness, that quality of complete repose by the nature of the language, and you feel it more and more till you feel what they feel. So that here's these warriors gung-ho to take on the world, and then they gradually... And he does it in, 4, 8, 11. And notice the tremendous variation in the rhythmic lines and the type of rhyme he uses. I'll point those out both later. But first, just try to get the feeling of these, what is it, 9 lines. There is sweet music here that softer falls than petals from blown roses on the grass, or night dews on still waters between walls of shadowy granite in a gleaming pass. Music that gentlier on the spirit lies than tired eyelids upon tired eyes. Music that brings sweet sleep down from the blissful skies. Here are cool mosses deep, and through the moss the ivies creep, and in the stream the long-leaved flowers weep, and from the craggy ledge the poppy hangs in sleep. You see what he's done, especially those last 4 lines. Look at first the meter. It's 3, 4, 5, 6. So you are always expecting, and it's dragged out, and it just gets heavier. Da da da, da 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 da, da 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 da. So it's like it's getting heavier and heavier, and at the same time he's using the longest, slowest vowel sound. That's not hit, bit. You know, it's deep, creep, weep, sleep. And the combination of that continuously expanding meter with the heavy vowels and then the sweet music and the tired islands and the poppy hanging. And, you know, it's brilliantly, brilliantly done, and the net effect at the very end, the last words before they fall asleep, Ulysses says, "Surely, surely, slumber is more sweet than toil, the shore than labor in the deep mid-ocean wind and wave and oar. Oh, rest ye, brother mariners, we will not wander more." And they go to sleep. So they wake up and all is well. But it's just for a poetic, as a sheer example. We were taught that in college and actually taught it correctly. And he was instantly my favorite poet for being able to write 4 such brilliant lines. And we had to recite aloud in those days. By the time 30 people said, "Here are cool," you know, you're fast asleep. But for extracurricular reasons as well. Now, as a change of pace, two quick favorites of Ayn Rand, both in regard to morality. We found these in her papers. I didn't know about them while she was alive. The first, a very bitter one, on moral judgment. She's basically echoing the line from Dante. The poem is that the lowest of all are the people who don't pronounce moral judgment. So it's a very bitter poem. A reader sent it in to her, one of her fans, in 1965. That's all I know. Author unknown, it says. And this is the poem, short. She saved it all those years and was in her papers when she died. Mourn not the dead that in the cool earth lie, dust into dust. The calm, sweet earth that mothers all who die, as all men must. Mourn not your captive comrades who must dwell too strong to strive, each in a still-bound coffin of a cell, buried alive. But rather mourn the apathetic throng, the cowed and the meek, who see the world's great anguish and its wrong, but dare not speak. And the total fan letter says, dear Miss Rand, thank you, dots, for speaking. And you see, the idea is don't mourn the people who have died. Don't even mourn the heroes in prison. If you want to mourn, mourn the people who see what's going on and dare not speak. And that obviously hit her where she lived. There's no name. All I can say is 1965, and the fan was from the Avco Corporation, AVCO, in Lowell, Massachusetts. The first line? Oh, mourn not the dead that in the cool earth lie. And mourn is M-O-U-R-N-E. So that sort of suggests an older poem. And here's a little cute moral poem that she loved. She found it in 1960 in a magazine called Success, the July-August issue. It's four lines. And the author, by the way, is A. Nani Mus. Spelled as three words. Why should you begrudge another the fortunes he does reap? Bless him, he's one brother that you don't have to keep. Now I'm going to take a bit of the question period, if that's okay with you, to read you just, well, I got a lot here, but at least two I want to read as an example of inspirational poetry. Both fabulous poems, and I got a lot more, but we'll leave them for the third lecture. Inspirational poetry is one that stresses some virtue, strength, heroism, persistence, courage. And they're obviously called inspirational because they inspire you. And there's one on Columbus that I love that I have to read. I just couldn't not read this one. It's on the virtue of persistence, of never giving up. And when they start maligning Columbus on Columbus Day, this is the poem that you should hear on the radio or you should think of. And I'll point out a few artistic elements in it after I read it. This is really Man the Hero. It's called Columbus by a Cincinnatus Heiner Miller. Never heard of him otherwise. It says known as Joaquin, or is that Joaquin? Even the name is Joaquin? Okay. Known as Joaquin Miller. He was born 1841 and died 1913. And this takes place on the ship in 1942. Was it Santa Maria he was on? In mid-ocean. On the way to the New World, if they find it. Of course, his map maker had drawn the ocean, and after a certain point, said, "Here lie horrors," or "Here lie terrors." And that's all they knew, what was to come. The whole thing is a dialogue between the first mate and Columbus. The mate is terrified, and most of each stanza is the mate, and then at the end comes in Columbus. And there's five stanzas. Behind him lay the gray Azores, behind the gates of Hercules. Before him, not the ghost of shores, before him only shoreless seas. The good mate said, "Now must we pray, for lo, the very stars are gone. Brave admiral, speak, what shall I say?" Columbus, "Why say, sail on and on." And the mate, "My men grow mutinous day by day, my men grow ghastly, wan, and weak." The stout mate thought of home, a spray of salt wave washed his swarthy cheek. "What shall I say, brave admiral, say, if we sight naught but seas at dawn?" "Why, you shall say at break of day, sail on, sail on, sail on, and on." You see, he repeats it four times. In prose, that will be a disaster. But the meter forces you to, and so it sounds perfectly real to you. "They sailed and sailed as winds might blow, until at last the blanched mate said, 'Why, now not even God would know, should I and all my men fall dead. These very winds forget their way, for God from these dread seas is gone. Now speak, brave admiral, speak and say.' He said, 'Sail on, sail on, and on.'" They sailed, they sailed. Then spake the mate, "This mad sea shows his teeth tonight. He curls his lips, he lies in wait with lifted teeth as if to bite. Brave admiral, say but one good word. What shall we do when hope is gone?" The words leapt like a leaping sword. "Sail on, sail on, sail on, and on." Then pale and worn, he kept his deck and peered through darkness. Ah, that night of all dark nights. And then a speck, a light, a light, a light, a light. It grew, a starlit flag unfurled. It grew to be time's burst of dawn. He gained a world. He gave that world its grandest lesson. On, sail on. Isn't that good? See, he saves the broader meaning for the very last line. When it's in its literal meaning, the meter, he places it so that you repeat it. Do it, do it, do it. But at the end, when it's a lesson, it's condensed to just one statement, sail on, because we already have the whole context and the whole meaning, and it's put in the most powerful position. So it hits you as the final gong. I always think that this is a great poem, and I hope you like it. And before I get to the question period, can I just read if? Okay, this was Ayn Rand's favorite poem. She asked to have it read at her funeral, and it was. It's Kipling's most famous poem. And it's his description of the ideal man. It's just called If. This is the mastery of poetry that you should see in this is that the rhymes are completely natural. It's not contorted or artificial. It's as you would speak. And yet he gets these tremendously complex thoughts that rhyme and scan so they have all the power of poetry. If you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you, if you can trust yourself when all men doubt you, but make allowance for their doubting too, If you can wait and not be tired by waiting, or being lied about, don't deal in lies, or being hated, don't give way to hating, and yet don't look too good, nor talk too wise. If you can dream and not make dreams your master, if you can think and not make thoughts your aim, if you can meet with triumph and disaster and treat those two impostors just the same, if you can bear to hear the truth you've spoken, twisted by knaves to make a trap for fools, or watch the things you gave your life to broken, and stoop and build them up with worn-out tools. If you can make one heap of all your winnings and risk it on one turn of pitch and toss, and lose and start again at your beginnings and never breathe a word about your loss. If you can force your heart and nerve and sinew to serve your turn long after they are gone, and so hold on when there is nothing in you except the will which says to them, hold on. If you can talk with crowds and keep your virtue, or walk with kings nor lose the common touch, if neither foes nor loving friends can hurt you, if all men count with you, but none too much, if you can fill the unforgiving minute with 60 seconds worth of distance run, yours is the earth and everything that's in it, and which is more, you'll be a man, my son. Is that good? You can't top that, period. So Ayn Rand actually used lines from that in her writing, if those of you who know her work. She quoted, I think, the line, if you can bear to hear the word, the truth you've spoken, twisted by knaves to make a trap for fools, and she wrote, I can bear it, you know. The only line that she disagreed with is, if you can meet with triumph and disaster and treat those two impostors just the same, as though triumph was not real. But I think you could interpret it to mean, every triumph, you can go on to a higher triumph, so don't say this is the end. That's a loose reading, but just to rescue him from that. Okay, I'm going to take questions on either poetry or more broadly, whatever. I mean, Yugoslavia or you name it. I guess you have to come to the mic, is that right? If I don't get any questions, I'm going to read more poems. Oh, there's different. You're over there? I can't see that far. Phil, yes.
Yeah. Why did Ayn Rand characterize Anthem as a poem?
Well, she said it was poetic. She did not mean it was a poem. It doesn't rhyme. But it's poetic in the sense of the rhythm, and it's poetic also in the sense of the biblical language, the special language that counts on sound. It had the element of counting on the sound of the words. It's not a literal prose work. They don't speak the way the characters in The Fountainhead or Atlas do. So the most I would say that's justified in that she was sort of, using hyperbole. It has poetic elements, but it's not certainly a poem. Betsy.
Yes, you said you like Tennyson, and I do too. Could you mention some of the other Tennyson poems you like?
Okay, there's a lot of great brief poems like Break, 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 Crossing the Bar. But I'll tell you my top favorite poem, which I did not have the courage to read because it makes me cry. And I'm going to sit up here. I get a catch in my throat in a lot of poetry, but I actually start crying. And it would be ridiculous to stand up here and charge you money, and sob throughout. But if you want the experience of a tremendous emotion, this is a tragic poem, but not a malevolent one. It's a love story about a mother for her son, and what happens to him, and what she does. And I read that in college, and that had a haunting effect on me. And I always cry when I read that poem. It's just amazing. And we had a poetry reading at a friend's. You know, the way some of the kids around the country have drama readings, well, we have sometimes poetry readings. And the idea is to just bring one or two poems that you really like, and each person reads a poem, and then, you know, you talk about it and have wine, etc. And these were people that I knew, so I had the courage to read this poem. And of course I cried, but happily quite a number of the others had cried or had tears. And it was a big success, and I discussed at that time, should I read that before the audience? And the consensus was, no, you shouldn't. It's not professional, etc. Anyway, it's called Rizpah, R-I-Z-P-A-H. And I own a whole collected works of Tennyson. It's not well known, but somehow I got it when I was in college. And if that doesn't sell you on the genius of Tennyson, then give up poetry. That's what I would say. Yes, Mark.
Can you tell us anything about the book you're working on?
Well, I'm not actually working on a book. I'm on the preliminary phase of two different projects. The one which would be a book would be a philosophy book. And all I've done so far since the radio show stopped is read through everything I've written or taught since Ayn Rand died. It's about 17 years of stuff. And take notes on any points that I think haven't been covered in OPAR and are worth covering. And I have two big legal-sized tablets of very abbreviated notes. And what I want to do now is go over with red and underscore any points in those notes that I actively want to write about. And I hope that, you know, I can winnow it down, and then I want to see, is there a thread uniting them? If they are all connected, then I'll write a book on that. If they're not, I won't, because I don't believe in episodic books, you know, of an essay, a thought on this and a thought on that. The closest I have to a theme that seems to put them all together, believe it or not, is that line of Hegel, you know, that I quoted, the true is the whole. Because everything comes to how do you retain a whole in the face of the complexity and diversity of life and the perceptual level. So much of what I did comes at that from one way or another. So many Ford Hall speeches, the attack on the visual, the why should you think in principle, etc. And what's wrong with rationalism and empiricism. So I'm thinking, now this is tremendously tentative before I even know if I've got a book, but I have a title that I like if this book ever came to pass, and that is The Whole Truth. See? And it would be a play because the whole would be the central idea, but you know, then it would be like a boast. This is the whole truth, you see. So I'm thinking of that, and whether that'll come to pass, it's really 50-50 right now, I don't know. The other thing I am more definite about is a book on education, which would take as its core those old lectures I gave in the 80s on education, but written as one continuous book, and then integrated with them at relevant points the elements from different speeches that can be brought under education, like why should one think in principle in connection with why you have to teach in principle, or what's wrong with visual education in connection with that talk I gave, I forget it, what's it called, a picture is not an argument. And a lot of those things can be brought into education. And it could be one continuous, you know, in my what's wrong with why Johnny can't think, and there's a lot of stuff that, but I wouldn't do it as essays because essay collections don't sell. I would weave it together into one continuous book with a positive and a negative element. And then at the end, as an appendix, I would include the Comprachicos by Ayn Rand and The one on the anti-conceptual mentality. Well, I never remember the name of that. The Missing Link. And I'm also going to include at the end Lisa Van Dam's talk, I have her permission, on as a separate talk given by her on homeschool education as the application of it. And to try to make it newsworthy, I'm going to have an opening or closing or both chapter on the Columbine disaster and the whole epidemic in the schools and what causes it and what is its cure. That'll be like the peg. I'm still struggling in my old age for a book that will sell. And maybe if I do that, maybe, you know, give it a tie, and there's a big thing about education now. Whereas the whole truth, you know, will sell 3 copies, and I already know who those people are. So it's easier to phone it into them, you know. Than those are the projects, I'm pretty sure the one on education is going to come to pass. The other one is iffy. Amy. Yeah, but I just want to know, does anybody else? I can't. Yes.
Do you know the poem Gunga Din by Rudyard Kipling? Do you like that?
I don't know it.
Oh, you don't?
No.
It's my favorite poem.
Well, can you give me a copy?
Yeah, sure. I'll write it out.
I've got do you know it?
Yeah.
Yeah. How long is it?
82 lines.
82. I can't ask you to.
Yeah.
See, what I do is browse. I never read straight through. I do it strictly for pleasure. And sometimes, I'll tell you, this is what I do as to whether to pursue a poem. I get great, big, thick anthologies, which you can get cheaply in used bookstores or rent at libraries. You know, this thick, and it's poems from, you know, the beginning to the end, from Chaucer, and et cetera, on to the latest junk. And I just start at the beginning and read the first 2 lines aloud. And if I don't like them, that's it. If the subject doesn't appeal to me, or it's archaic language, or there's mythological references I don't get, it's wiped out. Because there's zillions of them, I can't, you know, I'm doing it for pleasure, and I give it 2 lines, that's it. So I get through a lot of poems that way. But every 5-10 pages, there's one, okay, I could read that. Just I could read that. And I go on, and if I get to the end of the poem and it holds up and everything, that's one that I found. And I can get out of those big anthologies, and everybody chooses a different set of poems, of poets, or of poems from within the poets. You can get 10, 20, 30 poems that you never heard of. If you go plow through one of those big ones, and it's not a lot of pain because you just keep skimming. But I do have the collected works of 3 or 4 poets that I really like, but I don't know that one. Maybe I was put. What are the first 2 lines?
You may talk at gin and beer when you're quartered safe out here.
Say it again?
You may talk at gin and beer when you're quartered safe out here.
I should go on with that. That would keep me going, but I haven't come across. Of the poets that I most like are Tennyson, Kipling, and Browning. I'm going to read one from Browning next time. Are my 3 top favorites. And of course, in a different vein, Ogden Nash, who's a continuous delight. You know, he's the author of Candy is Dandy, but Liquor is Quicker. All right, do you want to ask a question? Yes.
I'd really like to hear you read Rizpah.
Oh, I don't have the courage to do that.
I was thinking it's completely worth my money, even if you are crying, because you're reading it.
You know.
And I was just wondering if you'd reconsider it.
You know, to prevent that very thing from happening, I left it at home. Because I knew someone would say that. I don't even have it. I made the decision at home. If I got to know you all, you know, really well, but I've become very vulnerable. You know, and I'll lose my dignity and authority. Yes.
I remember hearing this one. It's very short, and as a child. But
all right, belt it out now.
Is it Ogden Nash? That's the question.
Belt
Fuzzy
it
Wuzzy
out.
Was a bear.
Say it again.
Is that it? Is this Ogden Nash or? If,
is that?
Fuzzy
that
Wuzzy
wait ha- 1 minute. Is that? Where's JJ?
Is that Ogden
where's
Nash?
Where's JJ?
Is my question.
Can you raise your hand? Where I?
Or
is that
just
one of yours?
The kids say, or?
That's not one of yours. Okay, could we have a little treat at the very end? Okay, go ahead.
It's simply Fuzzy Wuzzy was a bear. Fuzzy Wuzzy had no hair. So Fuzzy Wuzzy wasn't really fuzzy. Was he?
Yeah, that's...
I was just thinking...
That had to be Ogden Nash. Yeah.
It sounds so much like him. That was my question. Is it him?
It has to be. I don't remember that. But it has to be. Oh, no, wait a minute. Is that you, Jim? No, okay. One last question, and then... We have a little surprise for you in the last 3 minutes, but go ahead with your question.
Would you compare and contrast the sense?
I hate those. It sounds like a final in college.
Could you elaborate on the sense? The sense of satisfaction you experience when you read a good malevolent universe poem compared with a good benevolent universe poem.
Well, as I said, I never read a really good benevolent universe poem. There would be an added element of enjoyment when you agree with the content. There's no question, if I read Atlas Shrugged and Crime and Punishment, I am exalted. There is no comparison because you have... the appreciation of the artistry plus, you know, the truth of the viewpoint, so you can walk in that universe and completely live in it in total harmony with it. Whereas when you're in Dostoevsky's universe, you marvel at the fact that you're in this universe and how he gets you in, but it's not a universe you want to live in. It's Ayn Rand described it as like you go through a chamber of horrors with a powerful guide. So you're aware of the powerful guide, but still there's all these horrors. So if you want to draw from that the moral, well, why not read only good things then in content, because you get a better, I would say, number one, there are not that as many, and you're cutting off a lot of where you could get artistic satisfaction, you know, secondly, some of those where you isolate just the artistic satisfaction enable you to appreciate the positives even more, because in your mind you can grasp how much more you're getting than when you just read a great but malevolent poem. So there's no question it's better to read a great benevolent poem. But that doesn't take away from the value within, you know, reason of reading a great malevolent one. Now, at this point, I want to invite J.J. Schumacher to come up, help him onto the stage. What does he need for a mic? Okay. Now, J.J. is a student at Lisa Van Dam's home school. And he was a classmate of my daughter in a younger grade. And Lisa had final exercises when the school finished its year. And one whole segment was poetry, read, memorized. That's what we had to do in school, memorize. We had to memorize vast, long poems and recite them. And all the kids in the class recited their poems. And JJ did such terrific Ogden Nash little gems that I prevailed on him to finish today by a few of them. So you're not nervous, right? Do you want a sip of water? Okay. Just give the title. Just exactly as you did it then. Go.
The pig, if I'm not mistaken, supplies a sausage, ham, and bacon. Let others say his heart is big. I call it stupid of the pig. A mighty creature is the germ, though smaller than a pachyderm. His customary dwelling place is deep within the human race. His childish pride he often pleases by giving people strange diseases. Do you, my puppet, feel infirm? You probably contain a germ. The duck. Behold the duck. It does not cluck. A cluck it lacks. It quacks. Especially fond of a puddle or pond. When it dines or sups, it's bottoms up. The panther. The panther is like a leopard, except it hasn't been peppered. Should you behold a panther crouch, prepare to say ouch. Better yet, if called by a panther, don't answer. The ostrich. The ostrich roams the Great Sahara. Its mouth is wide, its neck is narrow. It has such long and lofty legs, I'm glad it sits to lay its eggs.
You see, if kids get training at a young age, and not just in Ogden Nash, but also serious poetry, and they read it aloud, they understand it, and they enjoy it, they have an invaluable asset for the whole rest of their lives. They're not scared of poetry, and there's a whole new dimension opened up to them. And I hope that we're making a dent, for those of you who don't know poetry, on how to go about enriching your lives. So thank you, and we'll continue and conclude tomorrow afternoon.